right, well, good morning and welcome to LifePoint. If we haven't had a chance to meet, my name is Matthew. I serve as the teaching pastor here at our Westerville campus. And I'm grateful to be back with you this week. My family and I, we were in Florida last week, spending some time with our family down there. But I'm glad to be back and to be here for the rest of the summer. One quick thing, if today is your first time visiting, welcome. We're grateful that you're here. One thing that we'd ask from you, there's a QR code on the seat in front of you. If you'll scan that, that'll take you to lpguest.com. There's a guest form we'd love for you to fill out. There's also a section called Notes where you can follow along with during today's sermon. And then on your way out today, if you stop at Guest Central, we have a gift that we would love to give you just as our way of thanking you for being with us today. If you have your Bible with you or have the Bible app on your phone, go ahead and find your way to Song of Songs, chapter 4. We're in the middle of a teaching series called Love Songs, where we're walking through the book of Song of Songs and looking at what the Bible has to say about love, sex, and marriage. And I'll tell you, today is the one a lot of people have been waiting for the whole time throughout the series. Today's message was actually originally scheduled for last week, but I knew I wasn't going to be here. And so I gave Dustin a choice. I said, Dustin, do you want to preach about sex or do you want to preach about conflict? Do you want to talk about their honeymoon or their first fight? And surprisingly, Dustin chose their first fight. He chose conflict. I'm not really sure what that says about Dustin, but so appreciate him leaving me this fun topic to tackle on my first week back. And I hope he's not expecting me to approve his next vacation request whenever that comes in. But today's message is really part two of an earlier message from this series. If you remember from a couple weeks ago, we talked about God's design and God's framework for sex. And back in chapter 3, the woman in this book, she gives us this warning. She says, "Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires." And this phrase is actually repeated three times throughout the book, in chapter 2, in chapter 3, and then again at the end in chapter 8. But essentially, it means this: don't get ahead of God's design for sex. Don't awaken romantic passion. Don't awaken sexual intimacy before the appropriate time. It's pretty much this warning to slow down and to operate, to live within God's design and God's framework. You see, we have been created and designed by God with a desire for intimacy. Like there's a deep longing within each and every one of us to connect with another person emotionally, spiritually, and physically. And that desire and for connection, that desire for intimacy, it is a good God-given desire. In fact, we see this all the way back in the creation narrative in Genesis. When Adam was alone in the garden, God looked at him and said, "It's not good for you to be alone." And so God created Eve so that Adam would not be alone, and he established the covenant relationship of marriage between them. It says, "This is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh." It says that Adam and Eve, they were both naked, they were both vulnerable, and yet they felt no shame. They were fully known by one another and also fully loved and accepted. You see, sex is this gift that God has given us to enjoy within the context of marriage, within the context of this covenant relationship. And God has set it up with these boundaries and parameters, not to be controlling or to be restrictive, but for our good, so that this gift would be a blessing in our life. But if you've been married for long enough, you know that it doesn't always seem like that. It doesn't always feel that way. Like, we don't always experience what God intends for our marriages. In fact, sometimes rather than being a gift, it becomes a source of hurt and frustration and disappointment within our marriage. And the reason for that is because we live in a broken and fallen world, and you and I, we are broken and fallen people. And every single marriage involves two imperfect people. two imperfect people who come into the relationship with their own set of expectations, their own set of baggage and brokenness and selfishness. And sex has a way of exposing these things, revealing these things more than maybe anything else. But you see, despite our brokenness and our imperfections and our selfishness, I believe that God desires something better for our relationships. God desires something better for our marriages. And so today, we're going to spend our time in chapter 4, which is all about this couple's wedding night. And this chapter is meant to be a celebration of this gift God has given us. It's meant to be a picture of the ideal of God's intended design for marriage. And this is what God also intends and desires for all marriage relationships. Now, just like the rest of the book, chapter 4 is filled with a lot of poetic imagery and a lot of poetic language. But you don't have to be Shakespeare to figure out what's going on in this chapter. And so as we're reading through it, if you're wondering at any point in time, does that really mean what I think it means? Yes, it absolutely means what you think it means. And for the first three chapters of Song of Songs, what you'll notice is the woman does about 80% of the talking as they're dating, as they're getting engaged, as they're getting married. But now on the wedding night, the man starts to do a lot more talking. He starts to chime in a bit. What a shock. And he begins chapter 4 by praising her physical beauty. And he does so kind of in a strange way. He compares her to several different farm animals. Wouldn't recommend that approach. I guess back then that was a great pickup line. He kind of goes through the list of the family farm. But then in verse 6, he continues on. He says this. I'm going to read all the way through. He says, "Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. You are altogether beautiful, my darling. There is no flaw in you." Verse 12 says this, "You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, with henna and nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes and all the finest spices. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon." And then she replies to him in verse 16. She says, "Awake, north wind, and come, south wind. Blow on my garden that its fragrance may spread everywhere. Let my beloved come into his garden and taste his choice fruits." And then he responds back to her in verse 1 of chapter 5. He says, "I've come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I've gathered my myrrh with my spice. I've eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and milk." I had a guy from the last service tell me that today was the first time he got his two friends from college to come and attend church. I was like, sorry, buddy. But there's really no need to go back through this chapter verse by verse. I'll spare you of that awkwardness. You get the picture of what's going on here. But what I want you to notice is the number of references in just this passage alone to a garden. In fact, there are 10 references to a garden throughout the book of Song of Songs. And the garden in this book represents the place of sexual connection for this couple. But the garden language that's being used throughout this book is not random. It's not an accident. It's not coincidence. No, Solomon is using this poetic language as an allusion back to the original garden, to the Garden of Eden. Back when Adam and Eve were united together and they became one flesh. And when that happened, God said that it was very good. Like, this was meant to be a picture of what God intended for marriage, of what God intended for sex, before sin entered into our world and corrupted this gift God has given us. And what we have to understand and realize today is that you and I, we live in the tension between what's real and God's ideal. Like, we're navigating this, like, what's real, the reality in our life, and what God intends and what God desires. We're trying to navigate things like love and sex and marriage in a very broken and fallen world. And this takes a lot of effort on our part. This takes a lot of intentionality because pursuing God's design, God's standard for these things is so different from our culture's view. It's so different from our culture's approach. But what we see from this passage is that good sex, the sex that God desires for married couples, it's not this magical state that you achieve. It's not this level that you reach, this level that you obtain. No, more so, good sex is this garden that you must learn to cultivate and to care for. Meaning that sexual intimacy within marriage, it must be developed and fostered and protected. Because it's not simply this physical act between a couple, it's spiritual, it's emotional, and it involves every part of who we are. And so with this garden metaphor in mind, here's the question I want to try to answer today. And you probably weren't expecting this question when you showed up at church this morning. How do we cultivate good sex in a marriage relationship? How do we cultivate and care for this gift that God has given us? And don't worry, this is not going to be a list of tips or techniques. There are a lot of pastors, they want to get into that lane. I'm going to avoid that. I'm not going to make it weird this morning. We're going to keep it PG. Instead, this is really more about our posture and our attitude towards our spouse. And so how do we cultivate this gift that God has given us? If you're taking notes this morning, the first thing is this, is that we extend grace. Listen, we all bring a set of expectations into our marriage when it comes to sex. I remember when Brooke and I were doing premarital counseling, our college pastor was marrying us, and he had no problem getting in the weeds about things, and he asked us, how often are you expecting to have sex once you get married? And needless to say, our answers were widely different. We had very different responses to that question. Listen, we all have our expectations. And typically, those expectations that we have, especially in this area of life, are never really communicated or expressed beforehand. But when those expectations that we have are not being met, it's very easy for us to grow frustrated with our spouse, where bitterness may start to develop in our heart, distance starts to grow between us and our spouse. For some of us, when this happens, we get accusatory with our spouse. We start to believe the worst about them. Some of us, when we're frustrated, we may start to get kind of passive aggressive with our spouse. Some of us, we just kind of give up and we withdraw and we shut down. But I believe that it's important that we extend grace to our spouse when those expectations aren't being met the way that we had hoped for, the way that we expected. And in Colossians chapter 3, Paul, he's writing to the church. He's talking about our interaction in every kind of relationship. But I want you to read this passage specifically within the context of a marriage relationship. He says, therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves, meaning put on compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience. Bear with each other and forgive one another if any of you has a grievance against someone. Forgive just as the Lord forgave you. And over all of these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. I want you to think back to the garden metaphor. You see, there are different seasons when it comes to gardening. There are seasons where you're preparing the soil and you're planting seeds. There are seasons where you're beginning to prune the plants or you're clearing out weeds. But not every season of gardening is going to look the same. Not every season of gardening is going to be as fruitful. But every season matters. And every season is still important. You see, oftentimes we simply have unrealistic expectations for the season of life and the season of marriage that we're in. We think we're going to live in the honeymoon phase, the honeymoon season forever, which simply isn't realistic. There are going to be seasons, maybe you've walked through this like my wife and I have, where you were struggling with infertility, and you were just dealing with just the emotional stress of that and the toll that it took on your relationship. There are going to be seasons where you have young kids at home, and you are maxed out, and you're exhausted, and you're overwhelmed, and you're just trying to keep your head above water. There are going to be seasons where you're dealing with health challenges and health complications, and you don't feel like the best version of yourself. There are going to be seasons where you have changes in your body and changes in hormones. Like, sex doesn't just happen in a vacuum. It happens in the context of real life, real situations, real seasons. And so it's important that we adjust our expectations based on the season that we're in, and that we extend grace to our spouse. Because the goal in marriage is not to constantly recreate year one. The goal in marriage isn't to get back to a season of life that we no longer live in. The goal is to grow richer in the season that you're in, to cultivate this gift, to develop this gift God has given us. But you see, even during those difficult seasons, those seasons that feel overwhelming and stressful and challenging, it's important that we still, number two, that we make it a priority. Listen, sex is not everything in marriage. It's not. But it's also not nothing. It's an important part of having a healthy marriage, a healthy relationship. And we need to make sure it's still a priority, even in those challenging seasons, even in those seasons where we don't feel like we're able to give the best version of ourselves. And you may be wondering, well, does the Bible actually say anything about that, actually say that it's important, actually say that it should be a priority? Well, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul gives very specific advice about this area of marriage. Listen to what he writes. He says, "The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, yet yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. Do not deprive each other, except perhaps by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." Listen, as a pastor, I've counseled with a number of married couples who are having struggles and challenges in their relationship. And oftentimes, the struggles centered around their sex life. But not a single time have I been told that the reason they're not having sex is because they have devoted themselves to a season of prayer or to a season of fasting. I've yet to hear that one. It's always something else. It's kids, it's stress, it's hormones, it's health. And so unless you are in a season where you are super spiritual and you are devoting yourself to prayer, it needs to be a priority in your marriage. And this isn't about doing this out of duty or obligation or because you feel like you have to, but because God has designed this as one of the primary ways that we connect with our spouse, not just physically, but emotionally and spiritually as well. Now, depending on the season and stage of life that you're in, the season of marriage that you're in, this still requires realistic expectations. It starts with us showing grace to our spouse. And it may require a lot more planning and a lot more intentionality than it did 10 years ago, but it still needs to be a priority for the health and longevity of your marriage. And I think there are some very practical things that you can do to help make this more of a priority. Maybe you're here today and you're like, hey, I would love for this to be more of a priority in my marriage. There are some ways that you can approach your spouse. Things like showing physical affection throughout the day, where you're holding her hand, you're giving them a hug, where every time you touch your spouse, it's not with the expectation that it's going to lead somewhere. It's making your spouse feel wanted and desired by building them up, by affirming them with your words, by encouraging them. It's understanding their love language and understanding the way that they feel valued and appreciated. You know, oftentimes in marriage, we give love the way that we want to receive love. But our spouse may be very different than us. They may have a different love language. And so it's important as a spouse to become a student of your spouse, to understand how do they feel loved? How do they feel valued and treasured? Is it acts of service? Is it quality time? Is it words of affirmation? Is it gifts? Is it physical touch? What can I do to show my love and affection and appreciation for my spouse? But even during those difficult seasons, we want to make this a priority. Number three is this, is to communicate openly and honestly. You see, problems begin to develop in marriage when communication stops happening. Because when you stop being open with your spouse, honest with your spouse, vulnerable with your spouse, a divide begins between you and you slowly start to drift apart. And other things start to fill in this divide, this gap that now exists between you and your spouse. Things like bitterness, things like resentment, things like apathy, things like false accusations and beliefs. And so in order to cultivate this gift, to cultivate a healthy sex life with your spouse, you have to be willing to talk about it, to be open and honest about it, where you go to your spouse and you just openly say, hey, here's what I need from you. And here's where I'm struggling. And here's where I feel insecure about this. And listen, I recognize that talking about sex is much more awkward than just having sex, which is why for many married couples, they go years, if not decades, with ever being truly honest about this part of their marriage, because it's an awkward conversation. It's uncomfortable. You have to be vulnerable. But listen, you will only be as close as you are honest. You will only be as close with your spouse as you are open and honest with them. And nothing in your marriage is going to get better without talking about it, without addressing it, without being vulnerable. And in James chapter 1, James gives us some advice on how to have difficult conversations. Listen to what he says. He says, my dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry, because human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. James says that in our relationships, especially in our marriage, we are to be quick to listen, meaning that we're actively listening to what they're saying. We're trying to understand where they're coming from. We're not planning our next response while they're still in the middle of talking. We're actually listening to what they're saying. And we're not just trying to hear the words that they're speaking. We're trying to read beneath the surface and understand what's going on in their heart. Because if you've been married long enough, you know that oftentimes your spouse will say one thing and you know it means something very different. And so you're trying to figure out what's going on in their heart. What are they thinking? How are they feeling? And we're trying to create this environment where they actually feel heard by us, where they feel like they can be safe to be open and honest and vulnerable about what's going on in their life. We want to be quick to listen. But then James says that we want to be slow to speak, meaning that we're going to be very careful and very cautious about the words that we speak, especially when we're talking about something as sensitive as this. We don't want to speak words to them that are going to tear them down or make them feel insecure about themselves. We don't want to say things that aren't true, like, well, you never, or you always. No, we want to speak words that are life-giving, that are encouraging, that build them up, that make them want to draw closer to you. And then James says that we are slow to anger, meaning that we don't allow our emotions to get the best of us. We're not going to speak out of anger to our spouse. We're not going to respond to them out of frustration. No, we're going to allow ourselves to be led by the Spirit within us, not by our feelings, not by our emotions. We want to act in a way, we want to speak in a way that shortens the gap, that closes the gap and the distance between us, quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry. And let me just add this before we move on. Man, if your spouse, man, has the courage to come to you about this, where they're being vulnerable and open and transparent with you, and they're saying, here's where I'm struggling, here's what I need. Man, don't be dismissive of that. Man, don't just blow them off. Don't respond immediately by getting defensive with them or being frustrated with them. Don't respond by saying, fine, I'll just give you what you want. No, you want to respond in a way where they feel heard. You want to listen to what they're saying. You want to try to understand, okay, what's going on in their heart? What are they feeling? What are they thinking? But in order for this area of your marriage to improve, you have to have the conversation. You have to be open and honest with your spouse. And finally, number four is this, is to approach with selflessness. You know, our culture teaches us that sex is all about you. It's about your needs, it's about your desires, it's about your fantasies, and you need to go and chase and pursue the things that make you happy, the things that satisfy you. And if you're in a relationship with someone who's not making you happy anymore, if you're married to somebody who's not meeting your needs and your expectations the way that you want, well, then you need to move on and find something new, because it's all about you. It's all about what you want. It's all about your desires. You see, sex has become entirely transactional in our culture, where it's the currency that is exchanged in a relationship. It's used as a way to reward or punish your partner. It's used as a way to try to control or manipulate your spouse. But listen, sex was never meant to be a selfish act. No, it was designed by God to be an act of selfless love towards your spouse. It was never meant to be about selfishness. It was never meant to be about your needs and your wants and your desires. You know, last week, Dustin talked about Philippians chapter 2 when he was talking about conflict. And this is a passage that I go back to repeatedly for different situations in life, different relationships. And it's one of those passages in Scripture where if we really applied it, if we really lived it out and embraced it, it would be a game changer for every single relationship in our life, especially our marriages. And listen to what Paul writes in Philippians chapter 2. He says, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, instead, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others." And so for those of you this morning who are married, here's a question that I would love for you to ask yourself today. Do you have a posture of selfishness or selflessness towards your spouse? Like when it comes to your marriage, when it comes to your sex life, do you have a posture towards your spouse of selfishness, where it's all about your needs and your wants and your desires? It's all about what you can get and take from your spouse? Or is it about serving and loving your spouse? Is it a posture of selflessness where you are valuing them, where you just, like Paul says, you're putting their needs and their interests even ahead of your own? What is your posture towards your spouse right now in this area of marriage? And so how do we cultivate this gift? And it starts by extending grace. We recognize that not every season is the same, that we need to have realistic expectations for the season, the stage of life, stage of marriage that we're in, and we extend grace to our spouse. But then secondly, we still make it a priority. We're intentional with one another. We continue to pursue one another. Thirdly, we're open about it. We have conversations. We have dialogue. We break down the wall of awkwardness, and we have those tough conversations. Here's what I need. And we're listening to one another. We're not getting defensive. We're not trying to push back. We're not shutting down. We're really trying to hear and understand one another. And then lastly, we're approaching with selflessness. This isn't about my needs and my desires. It's about how can I serve you? How can I value you and love you as my spouse? But you see, here's what we can't miss this morning. If you are looking to your spouse or your fiance or the person that you're dating, if you're married and you're looking to your sex life to meet your deepest needs and desires in this life, you are setting yourself up for failure. And you will be perpetually frustrated and disappointed because your spouse, as great as they may be, they were never designed or meant to meet your greatest need in life. And what will happen is you will crush your marriage, you will crush your spouse under the weight of those unrealistic expectations. If you're expecting your spouse to complete you, if you're expecting your spouse to fill every void in your life, you see, marriage and sex, as great as these things are, they were designed to point us to something far more real, to something far more lasting and enduring, to something even far more intimate. They point us to the one who designed us, the one who created us, to the only one in this life who fully knows us. All of our brokenness, all of our selfishness, all of our hurt, all of our baggage, and yet still fully loves us. Not because of who we are, not because of anything that we've done, but because of what Jesus has done on our behalf, taking our sin and our shame on the cross so that we can be known by God and we can be loved by God. C.S. Lewis says this. He says, if I find myself in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, no relationship can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. I was made for someone else who can satisfy the deepest needs and longings in my soul. Your marriage is simply a picture of an even greater love, the love that God has for you and that he has shown you through his son, Jesus. He's the only one who can meet those needs and those desires in your heart. And so before we head out this morning, I'd love to take some time just to pray for us and to pray for our marriages today. And so will you join me as we pray? God, we come before you today, God, thanking you for marriage, thanking you for our spouses in this room. God, we thank you for just the incredible gift that it is. And Lord, I recognize that whenever we talk about a topic like this that can be uncomfortable and awkward, Lord, I'm aware enough to know that this is this can be a challenge in marriage. And it's one of those challenges that we feel like we can't really talk to anybody about, and we can feel very alone and trapped in. And so God, I pray just for just a spirit of humility in our marriages. God, if there's a conversation that needs to be had, if there is forgiveness and grace that needs to be shown, Lord, that you would begin to reconcile whatever that may be. Lord, that you would begin to close the gap and the distance that may have grown in a relationship. Lord, the bitterness, the resentment, the apathy, Lord, I pray that you would do a work on those things right now. And God, we recognize that as great as marriages, as amazing as our spouses may be, Lord, they were not designed to carry the weight of our greatest needs. They can't fill the voids in our soul. Only you can. And so, Lord, I pray that we would not put a pressure or an expectation on our spouse to do that, but, Lord, that we would turn our eyes to you, to the only one who can give us purpose and unconditional love and grace and joy and peace. God, help us to look to you for the things that we need the most. Father, we thank you for your love. Thank you for your grace. And we ask all of this in the name of your son, Jesus.